What's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Michael Brown reporting. For the news at this hour, an estimated 14 million Americans are said to be losing their health insurance coverage next year if Congress approves the Republican plan to replace the Affordable Care Act, commonly known as Obamacare. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office says that is the cost of carrying out one of President Donald Trump's favorite campaign promises, repealing and replacing Obamacare.
The press is making Obamacare look so good all of a sudden. I'm watching the news. Looks so good. They're showing these reports about this one gets so much and this one gets so much. First of all, it covers very few people, and it's imploding. And 17 will be the worst year. And I said it once, I'll say it again, because Obama's gone. You know, things are going to be very bad this year for the people with Obamacare.
The leader of the Senate Democrats said Trump care would be a nightmare for American people, benefiting only the wealthy. Under Obamacare, 20 million people who previously could not afford health insurance are now covered, but rising premiums could threaten coverage for some. President Trump plans to quiz German Chancellor Angela Merkel about her experiences dealing with Russian President Vladimir Putin when the chancellor visits the White House later this week. The meeting, originally scheduled for Tuesday, will instead be held on Friday due to a snowstorm arriving here in Washington Monday night. Trump officials suggested to reporters that the president wants to look past his highly publicized differences with the German leader and form a strong common position on issues ranging from trade to Kremlin cyber warfare to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. From here in Washington, this is VOA News. Two members of the United Nations panel of experts for the Democratic Republic of Congo are still missing after being kidnapped on Sunday. The Congolese communications minister told VOA Monday night the American and Swedish citizens had been abducted by unidentified negative forces. The UN said in a short statement it is doing everything possible to locate the experts. Scotland's first minister took a step closer Monday to breaking up the United Kingdom by announcing she intends to begin the legal process of holding a new independence referendum for Scots. The Scottish leader says Britain's Conservative Prime Minister, Theresa May, had failed to consult Scotland before deciding on a hard break with the EU, which will see Britain not only end its political membership in the European bloc, but will also see it exit Europe's single market with major economic consequences. Another consideration for the Scots is if they leave the UK, Britain, will they automatically be part of NATO? This is the NATO Secretary General, Jens Stoltenberg.
Not automatically, because by leaving the UK, it will also leave NATO. But of course, it's absolutely possible to apply for membership, and then the Allies would then decide whether any new independent entity or state will become a part of NATO.
Scotland elected to remain a part of the United Kingdom in a September 2014 referendum, which was then billed by Scotland's first minister as once-in-a-lifetime vote. Somali officials say pirates hijacked an oil tanker in the Indian Ocean and guided it to the coast of Puntland region on Monday. Sources tell VOA Somali service that the ship is believed to be a merchant tanker flying the flag of the United Arab Emirates. Regional officials say they are still assessing the circumstances of the hijacking. And Poland says it will seek the arrest and extradition of a Minnesota man identified by the Associated Press as a former Nazi commander responsible for massacring 44 civilians in World War II. Polish prosecutors say, according to the evidence of the office has been collecting for several years now, authorities are 100% certain that 98-year-old Michael Karkok is their man. The Associated Press says Karkok lied to U.S. immigration authorities after the war before settling in the northern state of Minnesota. For details and much more news, we invite you to join us at our website. That is voanews.com. From here in Washington, I'm Michael Brown reporting.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today is Tuesday, March 14th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The DRC government says it was not consulted about the presence of two UN officials believed to have been kidnapped.
That is a problem we have to discuss with our colleagues, the United Nations. We can't be sending people just like that to make fact-finding missions without informing local authorities.
Lambert Mende's Information Minister of the DRC, South Sudan demands the unconditional release of two Indian oil workers believed to have been kidnapped by Riek Machar rebels. And Liberia's Election Commission says it will enforce a Supreme Court ruling barring some officials from contesting the 2017 presidential election.
With the Supreme Court ruling, we now find ourselves on our obligation to ensure that that law is complied with. So what we'll be doing is to simply ask for proof of compliance for those people who we believe fall in that category.
Jerome Kokoya is chairman of Liberia's National Elections Commission. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari resumed work yesterday after returning from a month-long medical leave abroad. Protesters in Guinea-Bissau say they will continue their call for President José Mário Vaz to step down. And a new report urges South Africans to stop attacking immigrants and learn from them instead. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The DRC government says it was not consulted about the presence of two UN officials believed to have been kidnapped. The two officials, Michael Sharp of the United States and Zahedi Catalan of Sweden, were kidnapped along with four Congolese in Kasai Central Province. United Nations officials in New York would not confirm the two were kidnapped, but said the UN mission in the DRC, MONUSCO, had begun a search. DRC Information Minister Lambert Mende says his government had no knowledge about the presence of the two UN officials until the villagers reported it to authorities. Mende says the DRC government plans to discuss with the UN to stop sending people on fact-finding missions without first informing local authorities. He describes as bad cooperation between his government and the United Nations.
We were informed this night that they were kidnapped yesterday, and we were very much surprised to hear that they were there in Kasai Central Province, because until the villagers reported it to the authorities in the capital city of the province, we did ignore that these visitors were there. They reached Kananga and hired motorcycles and went to these roads. That was an insecure road because there are many terrorists around there. We are fighting some terrorist groups there. And they were, it seems they met those bandits in a place called Moyo River, 120 kilometers from Kananga, the capital city of the province, where they have been seen for the last time. And the whole day we did all our best to find them together with MONUSCO people, but we failed. And tomorrow morning we shall resume the research if we can find the place, to locate the place they are found.
I do not understand, Mr. Minister, how they can be in your country and you don't have any idea. These people, I assume, are working for the United Nations.
That is a problem we have to discuss with our colleagues, the United Nations. We can't be sending people just like that to make fact-finding missions without informing local authorities. That is something is dysfunctional. We do condemn it. We are really disappointed for that. And now we are implicated in this problem, and they have hired four Congolese that have been hijacked with them, and they are six of them now. Six people we are looking for.
I know some time back there was some friction between your government and the United Nations. How is that going? And could this be part of that friction? The fact that you say you do not know how these people got into the country.
There is a bad cooperation between us and the United Nations in Congo. We must say it. This is not acceptable. You know, MONUSCO has a status here. They are not forced to refer to the immigration officers because they are United Nations mission. But we thought that we must cooperate. So we think that by now we must really revisit the way of cooperating with MONUSCO and the UN in general.
The group that supposedly kidnapped the people, do you have any idea what group might have done that?
You know, we are in the Kasai Central region where our troops are busy fighting a terrorist group called the Kamuina Sampo. We have lost already more than 30 policemen, teachers, priests, you know, churchmen, clergymen, businessmen, and just civilians being killed like that by those people. And we could have at least give them an escort or try to tell them not to take that road, but they didn't refer to any local authority.
So has your government launched any kind of complaint to the United Nations?
Yes, it is what we are doing. The Internal Affairs Minister is now in Tanga, and the whole day we were at the operation to look for them together with MONUSCO. Tomorrow we shall resume this search. And we hope really that we shall find them alive.
Lamba Mendes, Information Minister of the Democratic Republic of Congo. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kinshasa. The South Sudan government is asking forces loyal to SPLMIO leader and former First Vice President Riek Machar to unconditionally release two Indian oil workers they kidnapped in Adaa oil field last week. Information Minister Michael Makui told reporters in Juba on Monday that rebel forces are demanding a ransom for the release of the two oil workers. But Riek Machar's rebels deny they have demanded any ransom. Tito Justin reports from Wau.
Information Minister Michael Makwe says the two Indian nationals were kidnapped Wednesday morning. He says the two were on routine patrol at the Adaa oil field when their car was stopped by what he calls outlaws and terrorist elements operating in Mawuti State. Makwe says Juba was dismayed to hear about the kidnapping of Ambrose Edward and Midam Kanes.
The Tigono would like to make the following. One, unconditional release of the two Indian nationals immediately. Two, calls upon the IGAD to condemn Riek Machar and his followers and blacklist them as terrorist negative force and ensure the safety and unconditional release of the oil field workers.
Makwe says the government also received reports that rebel forces are demanding $1 million in a ransom for the oil workers. He says South Sudan's transitional government of national unity does not deal with the terrorists.
Tigono is bound by international laws and UN resolutions and charters to counter terrorists wherever they are. The government is not ready to pay ransom that encourages terrorist acts and activities.
A SPLIO spokesman denies the group is demanding ransom but admits arresting the two workers. Lieutenant Colonel Lampaul Gabriel, the SPLIO deputy military spokesman, says his group arrested the two Indians because it does not want foreigners working in South Sudan's oil fields. He says the SPLMIO has formed a committee to interrogate the two Indians who he says are being held in Matiang village of Mawuti State.
That is propaganda and just unfounded accusation. That is not true. We never demanded any ransom for anybody caught. So after the investigation, if nothing is found bad with them, they'll be released and they'll go back safely.
Petroleum Minister Ezekiel Lolgat Kwot says the two foreign oil workers were kidnapped because they left their workstation without escorts. Gat Kwot says the government has learned a lesson and will take more strict measures to protect oil workers in the area.
We are not blaming anybody, but it would have been better for anybody working in the oil fields to take permission first before you go out. Because this one happened because there was no protection. If they were given us escort, they would have not been kidnapped. But now we have decided that to make sure that all the oil workers are protected, all the oil fields are protected. And this one is not going to happen again.
The two Indians oil workers are contractors with the Petronas Oil Company. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, March 14th, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 15 minutes past the hour. Liberia's Elections Commission says it will enforce a Supreme Court ruling barring some officials from contesting the 2017 presidential election. The court ruled earlier this month that a code of conduct requiring appointed government officials seeking to run for elected offices to resign their post 2 or 3 years before election was constitutional. This means a number of candidates running for the presidency and parliament would be disqualified. Jerome Kokoya, chairman of Liberia's National Elections Commission, says the commission will have to comply with the court's ruling. He says the commission will now request proof of compliance with the code of conduct from those appointed public officials who are seeking elected offices in this year's election.
You know, the Supreme Court is a court of final arbiter, especially on constitutional issues. I haven't read the opinion myself, but I've heard that the court upheld the code of conduct as constitutional. And that means, to the extent that we have to ensure its compliance to the aspect that referred or relates to the commission, we will have to make sure that that is followed up to the letter. And so, in short, we will have to comply with the Supreme Court ruling in full. It's just got a little part there that concerns the commission, and that has to do with those people who are Article 56 appointees in government. We understand the code of conduct requires that they're supposed to resign 2 years, in some cases 3 years, before any ensuing election where they have interest. So that is a little part that concerns the election commission. With the Supreme Court ruling, we now find ourselves on an obligation to ensure that that law is complied with. So what we'll be doing is to simply ask for proof of compliance for those people who we believe fall in that category. That's what we intend to do.
You mentioned what article, and I was just about to ask you whether you have any guidance from the Supreme Court in terms of who is it that you have to enforce this ruling by. Do you have any guidance?
Yeah, the article requires, that's the one that authorizes the president to appoint people, cabinet ministers, ambassadors, and other officials in the executive branch of government. That's what the president relies on to make all of our appointments in the executive branch. What I understand is that the code of conduct prohibits those people from running for office if they do not resign 2 years, and in some cases 3 years, before an election. So that is a code that the Supreme Court confirmed and upheld as constitutional. And those are the kind of officials we will be looking for if they did not resign 2 years or 3 years before.
Mr. Commissioner, does this include people who the president appointed to be members of boards of, say, of government corporations or something like that?
If the position falls within the Article 56, I would say yes. But I don't know yet what a board member or what is the distinction between a board member and an ordinary cabinet minister. So we have that to find out. I know the board members sometimes serve in a professional technical position. I don't know if it is the same as an ordinary cabinet minister. But when clarification will be needed, we certainly will get that from the Supreme Court. But as of now, the rule is that all those who were appointed by the president under Article 56. So the question now becomes whether a board member is one of those positions that were contemplated by Article 56. If that is so, then of course the rule will apply.
What's the progress now on your voter registration? We understand it comes to an end today, Tuesday.
Yes, Tuesday the 14th of March. It was originally scheduled to have ended on the 7th, but like I said earlier, we thought to add one additional week to compensate for some lost time we'll experience as a result of malfunction cameras in some of our areas.
Mr. Commissioner, besides the technical problems you mentioned, generally, how do you think Liberians have been reacting to the registration itself? Do you think that people have been registering, say, in droves?
Well, I would say yes, people have been registering, but you know, Liberia is a country where voting is not compulsory here. So it's one of the rights that people will choose to exercise for themselves. What we do as a commission is to provide the information and provide the facilities that will enable people to exercise their rights, and that we did.
Jerome Kokoya is chairman of Liberia's National Elections Commission, who is speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari resumed works yesterday, days after he returned from nearly a month-long medical leave abroad. Femi Adesina, special advisor on media and publicity to Mr. Buhari, says Nigerians had looked forward to their president returning to work, and they were delighted to see him. Mr. Buhari said upon his return last Friday that he had never been
so sick since he was a young man. Adesina says the president will have to gradually ease into working again. Adesina again refused to say what was wrong with the president, saying only the patient can disclose his or his illness.
It was a day we all looked to top government officials, his partner, aides, in fact, the whole country. The whole country looked forward to this. And so he came in to the delight of everyone. I, fortunately, was part of the aides that followed him right to the office. The first thing he did was to sign the letter to the National Assembly notifying them of his return to work. He signed that and it was transmitted to the National Assembly. Thereafter, the vice president came in to give him briefing, and that took a while. It lasted for well over an hour. The vice president was bringing him up to speed on the crucial things that happened while he was away. That was how it went.
As the president himself said upon his return, he's never been this sick before since he was a young person. What do you think his schedule is going to be like now that he's returned to work? Is it going to be a lighter schedule? Because I don't know if he's completely well yet.
Well, he has to pace himself properly. When you've been away for 7 weeks that he was away, you don't come in and attempt to do everything in one fell swoop. You begin to do it gradually and ease yourself into the work again. And that is how I believe that it will proceed.
Now, he mentioned also that he probably will be going back again for more treatment. Is that correct?
Yeah, for a review. You know, when you're on a course of treatment, your doctors may want to review you from time to time.
So the Nigerian people, have they been told in terms of what the president is suffering from?
We know how these things work out. Even in the Hippocratic Oath, it is clearly stated that it is the patient who can disclose what is wrong with him. Not even his doctor can disclose. So, is the president who can say it when he decides to say it? The law does not compel him to say it.
So you say that the president is ready to fully resume work?
He has fully resumed work, not just ready to. He has fully resumed work.
Femi Adesina is the special advisor on media and publicity to Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari. He was speaking with me from the capital, Abuja. Protesters in Guinea-Bissau said they will continue demonstrations calling on President José Mário Vaz to step down until the government takes action. Grassroots activists flooded the capital Bissau's streets on Saturday while voicing their displeasure with the current government. One of the event organizers, Carlos de Silva, told Ricky Schreier that thousands came out to voice their concerns. De Silva says the anti-government movement and a planned March 25th protest if the presidency does not respond to their demands.
Now, what we protested is to the president to be out because he's the one who created the crisis we are living, and now he's incapable to put the order, and the people are suffering. And we decided now to go on the street asking the president to step down. We did not want him anymore to stay in power.
What kind of reaction are you getting, Carlos, from the government at the moment?
Government don't want, you know, because if the president stepped down, it means that the government also will be, you know, dissolved. And they don't want him. That's why last week, last Thursday, they go on the street, give kids and young people money, 2,000, 3,000 to go on the street to say to open the assembly. They recruit a lot of youth and go on the street saying, okay, the assembly must be open, you know. And on Saturday, we respond and we say, okay, now is enough. We don't want you any longer. You and your president should go out.
And what is the next step then if it looks like he won't step down? Why do you think it's important that he step down?
The next step is that in the 25th, March 25th, we're going to do another protest again if he doesn't react until that time. That's we won't stop until he takes a decision.
What do you propose happens then? New elections or the prime minister takes over?
Yeah, we requested that It solved the parliament, and it called for a new anticipated general election. And because we see that easy the man who got the all this problem, if he keep on power, even if we do just the government election, it means that it will keep having problems with the people. We want general action. You give back the people the power, and the people decide on those they will elect.
What's the status of the budget? Is it still not been approved by the assembly, right?
No, the assembly, they have been not working for a long time. They close. They say until the president decided to put, because there were political agreements, and the assembly now are alleging that the president must to cope with the Conakry agreement. Otherwise, they won't open the assembly.
And that means there still is no national budget.
No national budget for all. It's almost 3 years.
That was Carlos De Silva, a spokesperson for the local group Movement of Conscious and Nonconformist Citizens. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Guinea-Bissau's capital, Bissau. At the height of the current xenophobic violence in South Africa, new research has shown that immigrants make substantial contributions to South Africa's economy. A report released by the South African Institute of Race Relations, or IRR, shows that instead of attacking immigrants, South Africans could learn things from them, including how to develop entrepreneurship skills, ways of growing the economy, and creating jobs. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
The report titled South Africa's Immigrants Building a New Economy reveals that most immigrants have relied on their entrepreneurship skills and hard work to survive in the country. The report says the immigrants, largely from Somalia, Ethiopia, Bangladesh, and Pakistan, operate 80% of the backyard grocery shops at homes owned by South Africans. For South African homeowners living in poor townships, these grocery shops provide a source of income from the rent the immigrants pay to run the businesses. Others have combined their financial resources to start businesses in towns. Some of these have grown into large wholesale stores that are now competing with well-known establishments. Rian Malan, author of the report and research fellow at the IRR, says through such self-created employment, only a few foreigners compete with the locals for formal jobs.
Foreigners arrive here, they have no right to be here, they have no papers, etc. They're desperate, they have no choice, they can't go back home. And against all odds, they've created a situation where the unemployment rate is half of what South Africa's is. By virtue of hard work and keeping their prices low and providing good service to people, they are making inroads in the market.
The research also found that immigrants who are not able to become self-employed have opted to work in restaurants, construction and farms where they are paid very low wages. The report, however, says even in these jobs, they've improved their economic conditions as well as the country's. Karen Lebone, analyst at the IRR and head of the Center for Risk Analysis, says if South Africans commit to learn from these foreigners, they will succeed despite difficult economic conditions.
Very, very industrious, also in finding opportunities. There's no sense of entitlement.
That was Tuso Kumalo reporting from Johannesburg, and that's it for this Tuesday, March 14th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer David Vandy, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Barton in Washington, hoping that everyone in Africa will have a great day.